It's time for another Cannabis Insider with the one and only Tony Noto. What's up, brother?
All right, man. How are you? What's going on, Elliot?
Not much, man. It's been a crazy Tuesday. There's been a few themes to my Tuesday. You want to tell you about them?
Two for Tuesday, like on the classic rock station? You play two songs in a row?
I do like that. Also, just a quick note to the audience. If you hear click clacks, my, like, 8-inch tall dog just opened my door. I don't know how that happened. It just happened. So here we are. Like, that being said, it's incredible. I don't know what she just did, but she's laying down, so we're good. That being said, what's up, y'all? Drop a one if this is your first time in Cannabis Insider and listening to us. Thrilled to have you all. Drop your questions throughout the day. We have two amazing guests today with the CEO of NASDAQ-listed Flora Growth Corp, FLGC, one of the leading international companies in Latin American companies. And then, just to throw a dichotomy at you, we're back stateside right after that with Brian Murray, the EVP of Government Relations at Acreage Holdings, one of the major MSOs for a while now. MSO being a multi-state operator. For those of you who may be new to the cannabis space, Tony, sick show today, man. This is going to be a lot of fun.
I'm excited. I think I've interviewed Brian before, so it'd be nice to see his face again.
Yeah, that's going to be awesome. That being said, I'm going to start, if you don't mind, with a headline that I find pretty interesting. And for me, I'm going to go to another OG of the cannabis industry, being MedMen. OTC listed MMNFF divests their Florida assets. They said peace to the Sunshine State and sold it to Green Century Holdings, which I believe, I could be wrong, but I think that you have the likes of like Brady Cobb and others involved in that. But that's going to be, I think, something to keep an eye on. And I talked about it in the newsletter this morning, but I'd love your thoughts. But I still think MedMen's footprint is very attractive. New York, Massachusetts, Nevada, New York because of Sin backed out, California. I don't know, man. What are your thoughts on this?
So MedMen, walk me through. MedMen sold its assets in California?
In Florida. Yeah. So they sold it to Green Century Holdings, but they're still in six other states.
So that's interesting. Wasn't it last week when you and I united on the Thursday episode that our guest was hyping up Florida as like the place to be? So that's interesting. Patrick Rea was
good memory.
Florida, and now this MedMen has exited and jettisoned its assets. It's interesting. I would like to explore that further. Maybe that's something for Marine and the team to delve into.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And interesting to note that this is right after Ascend Wellness backed off there. Tony, are you familiar with the saga of Ascend and MedMen?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so Ascend and MedMen, quick recap, quick history. Ascend and MedMen entered into an LOI for Ascend to acquire MedMen. Legislative stuff happens inside the state. MedMen wants to back out because they see how valuable their assets are. Understandable, still questionable. Things happen in there, some political, or not necessarily proven political tampering, but accused political tampering. A lawsuit happens. They settle the lawsuit and back off the lawsuit. And then I think they added like a small amount, a small percentage to the total deal for MedMen. And then as of like this week, Ascend backs out of the deal. So it's been a journey to get from this point.
Which it's interesting because like usually when an M&A deal is gets the ball rolling, usually they'll, if there's a problem that arises, they would rather almost settle and figure out, you know, the price point difference rather than back out entirely. So that's interesting.
Well, I think it's partially happening because of the state of New York. So I don't think Ascend is happy with the market. They think the market is rolling out very poorly. And that being said, it's really due to how they're approaching the social equity side. Not everybody in the social equity side is happy with New York either.
No. We touched on this a little bit last week, but to make a long story short, there's like a weird little thing that they're looking for. In order to get a license to sell cannabis as a retailer, you have to be already an established, successful business person, which kind of defeats the purpose of an up-and-comer who has probably a cannabis penalty on you know, on their record or prior arrest, looking to due to when it was prohibited, now it's legal and they're not really giving those folks a chance. It's kind of strange. And I would love to talk more about it if we have time. I don't know how much time we have.
Yeah, we got a few minutes here, but shout out to Sam Wetzel going for some M&A in the chat here. If you're on LinkedIn, respond to our boy, Sam. What up, guys? Currently selling my company. First of all, great name. Smokus Focus. Thank you for that. Appreciate you dropping that in there, Sam. Looking to sell 80% and then option for additional 20% in 12 to 18 months. Sam, drop in, what is Smokus Focus? Let's keep this theme going. That's going to be a theme of our show, is Smokus Focus. Fabulous name.
That is not the marijuana spoof version of Hocus Pocus.
No, I mean, we're trying not to go there. Now we may have to shut this down on YouTube. Come on, Tony.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just kidding, y'all. So anything you want to touch on, Tony, or do you want to touch on one more headline? Up to you.
Well, one more headline that I spotted was from our friends at MJ Biz, you know, pointing out that, and this goes into what we were talking about with Florida and New York, how for the first 7 months of this year, it was some of the markets that you wouldn't expect that that saw double-digit growth in their medical and recreational industries. Missouri had triple-digit growth, and Maine with triple digits, 174 and 159% respectively. Utah had an 87%, whereas states where you think that, you know, adult-use markets are well-established, like California, Colorado, and Oregon, it contracted, declining as much as 20%. So yeah. I thought that was interesting and worth noting for our listeners.
I love that. So not a recent conversation, probably like 3-4 months ago, I had with Steve from Sharp Capital.
There you go.
A really cool investment bank out of Chicago. They'll actually be participating in our September 13th to 14th Cannabis Capital Conference, bzcannabis.com. If you want to get tickets, the agenda is incredible. In fact, both of these amazing companies on today will be participating there. Mm-hmm. But Sharp Capital said there's not enough consumers in Missouri right now to support where the market's heading. And right now they're in a lawsuit to block recreational marijuana. So if they keep it medical, there are not enough medical consumers or openings for medical consumers to support the amount of companies in Missouri. So mm-hmm. Interesting. I mean, when will we see that obstacle actually slow down the market? I don't know. This is third party, but an interesting thing to watch as Missouri grows and maybe stalls out. But we'll see. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, that is fascinating.
Yeah. Awesome. The UK needs to legalize it. Buzz B, we hear you. We're with you. Life Group, Cureleaf International. There's several cool companies there working on it. I know probably Aconda is another good one, AKAN, on the NASDAQ. There's several cool companies there. We could probably get a take from Luis Marchand in a second on the European market in general. But, I mean, he's international. He's a genius on all of it. But we want to start with Flora Growth.
Yeah.
That said, I'm rambling now. So, Tony. Anything else you want to throw at our audience before we dive into these interviews?
No, let's delve in. I think if we have time at the end of the show, we can do a little bit of a news cap. But I'm excited to get to our guests. You know, Flora had some earnings to talk about. So did Acreage, and I'm on board.
Let's do it. Aaron, let's bring Luis Marchand, CEO of Flora Growth Corp, over. Is Mr. Michelle. What's up, my friend?
Hey, Elliot, thank you for having me, and I appreciate you calling me a genius.
Oh, please. we're here to blow smoke up anybody's butt. No, okay. Luis, it's good to have you on, man. There's a reason you are the CEO of one of the major international companies, and I'm thrilled to dive in. So let me start, and then Tony can feel free to interrupt me because I tend to ask a lot of followers. But Luis, just give us a quick rundown of your earnings. What did you release on the 15th, I believe, started last week?
Yeah, of course, Elliot. So we are exceptionally pleased about the results that we delivered on the first half. We announced that our revenue increased to about $15 million, up 600% from the first half of 2021 and 117% from the second half of 2021. Our gross profit increased to $7 million, up 547%. We reaffirmed our guidance, which is between $35 and $45 million for the balance of the year, which would represent about 300 to 400% growth. So those are the major highlights.
Very cool. And I just have a follow-up and then Tony dive in. How much of that is inorganic versus organic? Can you talk about such massive growth?
Yeah, like it's a combination of our corporate strategy, which is anchored on our three growth pillars. The first one is our cultivation and commercial growth pillar, which is based out of Colombia. We have a 100-hectare cultivation farm. We have deployed the capital expenditures necessary to activate that pillar in the second half of 2021. In fact, as we're speaking, some shipments are moving across the globe, and we're looking forward to announce those in the upcoming weeks. The second one is our house of brands, which represents about 85% of our revenues today. And our house of brand portfolio is a combination of both brands that have been incubated inside the company and brands that we have acquired. And the two that I'll highlight for you, Elliot, are Just CBD, which we acquired in February, and Vessel Brand, which we acquired late last year. And then lastly, is Life Sciences, which is our research and development arm of our company, and is focused on the pharmaceutical great products and the incredible benefits that cannabis will bring to patients worldwide.
Mm. That's great. All right. Well, I'm going to keep going then. So talk to me, Luis, about the Colombian market, because obviously there's a lot internationally that you have to work with. But some of the news I've covered for you recently has to do with your friendship with some Colombia politicians, and being your friendship, it's a synonymous word, but basically you're working with them to legalize the market. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you're positioning Flora Growth to take advantage?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this goes beyond Flora Growth. Flora, of course, believes in Colombia as the green breadbasket of the world. We firmly believe that if the regulatory framework is put in place, the best cannabis cost structure and higher quality flower is going to come from that country in South America. There is a new government in place. President Gustavo Petro was elected and took office on August 7th. And one of the members of his party, Senator Gustavo Bolivar, put forth a bill that will legalize cannabis for adult and recreational use. And that is very meaningful for a company like Flora, because right now we are able to export flowers and derivatives and even food and beverage products with cannabinoids, but only for medicinal purposes. So if this bill were to be legalized, not only we would be able to take advantage of the almost 9 million addressable market consumers that are inside of Colombia, but we would also be able to export flower and other derivatives for recreational and adult use purposes, effectively making Colombia a very attractive proposition, which is what we have always intended to do and why we started Flora in the first place.
Now, you met Senator Bolivar earlier this summer, correct?
I did. We have several interactions over the last couple of months, especially ahead of the announcement of the bill, as well as the election of President Petro.
So walk us through like what a meeting like that entails. I mean, I know that I would probably get a little starstruck with certain folks, and politicians could sort of be a little bit cagey in terms of what they talk about. What was the exchange like, and how do you, what did you tell him, and what any information that he needed from you to sort of put forward this legislation?
Right. Look, I think it's important to highlight that this is not a first time effort. As the CEO of an international company, we in many cases are helping countries develop the regulatory framework and helping them put it in place for it to make sense for both their constituents and the industry. So we worked with the prior government, and we had very close connections with the Ministry of Justice, the Secretary of Defense and Health, and ICA. But this was a collaboration with Gustavo Bolivar. Was immediately attached to the fact that he wants to take it a step further. Senator Bolivar had a bill already in place 3 years ago. It just didn't get enough support to get the votes to be passed as a bill. So that initial interaction was with regards to how do we make sure that we pass a bill that makes sense, that protects customers, that protects patients, but that also realizes the potential that Colombia has, which we have not been able to do so at the time. And with regards to being starstruck, I would say, Senator Bolivar has a very interesting background. He used to be a screenwriter. He's a very successful screenwriter, has won a number of awards, and has launched a number of very popular soap operas in Latin America. And he did this. He became a politician because he wanted to serve his country. He wanted to serve the communities in Colombia. And I think the spirit of the law is in tension, is to benefit Colombia, to benefit the economic growth, and obviously benefit a community that has been incredibly marginalized by the war on drugs. So I think our efforts are aligning to making Colombia a significant engine of economic growth through the cannabis trade.
Looking outward, just shifting a tad here, which markets for export do you think offer the biggest room for growth, for Flora growth? If we were to see you exporting something to Israel or to Germany or Portugal or wherever, what do you think is the biggest shot on goal for Flora growth there?
Yeah, look, it's important to highlight, Elliot, that we already are an international company that is generating meaningful revenue abroad. Today, that meaningful revenue may be an overstatement. About 3% of our revenues are considered international revenues, but we're selling in over 12 countries, including those that you mentioned, that you just mentioned. We're selling in Czech Republic, we're selling in Germany, we're selling in the UK. We're going to continue to expand. Some of our product offerings are in Hong Kong, in Mexico, and that is because we have a diversified strategy in which some of our product categories have lower regulatory barriers. That's what's so important about our company strategy, that we're able to open inroads at a much faster rate than companies that are only focused on the flower or the API trade, for example. But with regards to flower or APIs, we certainly believe that Germany is a market to watch out for. Certainly, there's a meaningful movement towards legalizing cannabis for adult and recreational use. We expect that to make some meaningful changes over the next 6 to 9 months. So we're watching out for Germany, and we're making meaningful evaluations of that market, and we expect to start sending our flower there. Switzerland is a very favorable market in terms of regulatory framework, especially for cannabis that is under 1% of THC concentration. And of course, we have meaningful agreements with both Israel and Australia, and we expect that the markets that I just mentioned will be the main contributors of our commercial and wholesale operation over the short term.
A recent analyst note pointed out the company's intention to not pursue capital infusion. Walk through that decision, and you know what the management believes it needs to accomplish to get the funds that it needs.
Well, it's important to highlight that we're in a good cash position. We announced that in the first half 2022, as of June 30th, we have $10.3 million in cash. Our company has no debt. So the decision of not seeking any capitalization is a result of our solid improvement in our financials and our operations. We expect that the growth trajectory that the company has in terms of revenue, as well as our consistent reduction on cash burn, will lead to us not having to infuse more capital into the company. Now, that being said, if there is an attractive M&A opportunity, or if there is an opportunity to expand and accelerate exponentially some of the revenue tracks that we have that makes sense financially for us, then we'll pursue some of those options. But because of our fundamentals, our company's in a good position to remain as is without raising more cash.
All right. I got to bring it home here, Luis. I gotta ask, man, what does it look like in the U.S.? Just CBD, Vessel Brands, you know, you have activations here and very strong ones. I'd like to understand a little bit about the growth opportunity within this market looking forward.
Look, it's massive value. Look, we haven't even started. If you think about it, the majority of our distribution is through either DTC, which we have a solid team and an expert team in that channel, over 500,000 consumers today that interact with our brands in the majority of the United States. And we have a very solid wholesale distribution channel that reaches up to 14,000 cannabis retail distribution, like the smoke shops of the world. But we are yet to be in any major mass retailer. We are in no grocery stores. We still cannot market openly to consumers. We're still not able to take advantage of all the tools that any normal company has at their disposal to capture customers, to reduce banking rates, and to have access to just proper mechanisms to operate a business. Once those levers are accessible to my company, we're going to be able to incredibly accelerate our revenue generation inside the United States. And we're going to say, Elliot, Florida is a place to be.
Yes.
I mean, we are in Florida. Florida is a pro-cannabis state. It has a tremendous amount of knowledge. We just hired Holly Bell, which was the head of cannabis for the state of Florida. She's our VP of regulatory at Florida today. We firmly believe that Florida has all the elements to become a major state for cannabis growth over the short and long term.
Awesome. I love how you brought that back, Luis. This is why you get genius. This is why you get the term genius. You get a full circle there. Luis, any last words, my friend? We got to wrap here, but honestly, so good to have you back on and catch up.
No, Elliot, look, I look forward to seeing you in person during the conference in Chicago, September 13th to the 15th, I believe. So very excited to be there in person, meet some of your audience and some of your investors. And look, make sure that you continue to follow our company. Our ticker is FLGC. We're doing some great things, and we look forward to connecting again.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Luis Marchand, CEO of Florida Growth Corp, NASDAQ-listed FLGC. Have a great one.
Thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Love it.
Yes.
So good to connect with them. They've had a killer year over year. And honestly, I don't expect it to stop. They're growing rapidly.
And the fact that he cited M&A as a potential tool in his utility belt, that's something to take note of. That he broke that news on this show, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Nomad, how big of a competitor in South America is Kyron for FLGC? I would personally say one of their biggest. I'm a fan of both of these companies. Kyron Life Sciences, though, watch out when the German market opens. They have some interesting, and really just in Europe in general, the UK and Germany, some interesting footprint there with their clinics. Florida Growth Corp, I think, is a little bit of a different, somewhat related, of course, but a little bit of a different approach to the market. So I think they could also work in tandem.
Definitely in tandem. And there's this, as you know, there's just tons of growth opportunity. There's supply issues are an issue. Supply issue. We have to factor that in. I know that that's been grabbing headlines as of late. So hopefully these companies can offset that in some way.
Absolutely. John Roeder, I agree. Great information and insight from Luis. With that being said, we're going to come back stateside. I kind of led into it with our last question there with Luis. But let's bring on Brian Murray, Acreage Holdings EVP of Government Relations. Mr. Murray, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on the show.
We're thrilled, man. Thrilled to have you. Thank you for joining us. I have a question that I like to start off with. Actually, a comment and then a question. First of all, we picked your most obscure ticker to put on our screen here. Apologies. We'll get you another one here shortly. We'll get you their OTC listing. But Brian, what does an EVP of Government Relations do for an MSO?
Yeah, that's a great question. So an EVP for Government Relations really leads government relations at the company. So of course, for Acreage Holdings, that's what I do. But that's more my title. I'll get it just to get into kind of what I do. What I do is I sit with the business and I sit with our regulatory and compliance leads. Really anyone that is trying to, and this is the whole company, trying to grow the company and the business, as well as the market environment. And I try to understand and ascertain what are the different challenges that we're experiencing, whether through regulation or legislation, that is either hindering patients, consumers, or operators from being able to make sure that cannabis gets into the most hands of the most people that actually want it. And as soon as I'm able to understand and ascertain those things, I work with my team. I'm a team of one, but I have lobbyists throughout the states that we operate to try to shape the market environment so that it is most conducive for cannabis operators, patients, well, where you have medical markets, and then, of course, consumers, where you have the recreational markets, so that everybody has access to cannabis where they need and want it. And so I pull, I do a lot around legislation. We worked very strongly on 280E reform in New York. Work on regulations as well. New Jersey just released its adult use regulations. And so I'm working to pull those comments together so that we, again, it's all about shaping the environment that we operate in, but consumers purchase in and patients get access to their medicines in.
It seems to me like you have one of the most important jobs at an MS. So I'm not going to make you agree or disagree with me.
Thank you.
I do want to pick your brain a little bit. You know, with government relations, with knowing lobbyists, knowing these politicians, it seems ill-advised not to. So, you know, let's look at the state we're in right now with just a plethora of bills to consider, a plethora of amendments to the CAOA. We have Safe Banking. We have more. We have Climb. We have Hope. I mean, can you help us out a little bit? Is there something that we can narrow in on as those? And let's, I would say the vast majority of our audience are sector agnostic. They're not necessarily specifically focused on cannabis. So is there something that they can look for peripherally in the next month or two?
Yeah, that's a great question. So right now, of course, we're in the August recess, and Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer, released, of course, the KOA Act, as you just alluded to. I think what we're looking for when it comes to cannabis is it's very difficult because of the way the United States is structured. Now, I'm glad of the way it's structured, but we're a nation of many states, and it's difficult for the federal government necessarily to say, okay, we're going to legalize cannabis, when you have several states that still don't necessarily want recreational cannabis. And so it's very difficult for, let's say, an executive like Biden to just kind of clean sweep, even though you find that, I think data suggests 67% of the nation would prefer medical. You have 90%, 90% are in favor of medical cannabis, 67% or 63% maybe, depending on the latest figures, are in favor of recreational. It's still difficult that way. So I say that to say, when we look at some of the bills that are before Congress, some of them are what we would consider comprehensive bills. And so they're going to, of course, legalize cannabis. They're going to create a regulatory framework. And for many people, that's too much too quickly. And so what we find then are different bills, like you mentioned, the HOPE bill, the Climb bill, Safe Banking, other ones that deal with certain elements of the cannabis marketplace. And it looks like Safe Banking has the most likelihood. And when I say likelihood, I put that in air quotes because things change in Washington quite frequently. But a lot of people recognize that operators in cannabis are being held up at gunpoint. We've seen people die because they don't have access to banking. And so what we find is where you have these intersections where legislation is not catching up with public safety, it's important then for legislators to take action. So when we see things like Safe Banking, that's one of the things that we're looking at. And then I imagine a more comprehensive bill will hopefully pass, you know, maybe next year or the year after. But again, I don't have a crystal ball. I wish I did. But that's a lot of what we're finding in Washington, is the sense that people are not ready for a comprehensive cannabis legislation, just because, again, across all 50 states, I'm in favor of cannabis. Of course, you're in favor of cannabis. But, you know, there's a lot of people who are not. And so, you know, as an executive, you have to look at the whole nation. And so I think it's taking some time there. What we really need in cannabis is people to call their legislators across the different states and to mention to them, that they're in favor of it, that they want them to kind of get support it, and to provide the data around cannabis. There's a lot of data to support cannabis use, both recreationally and medically. So, but hopefully that's a good answer to your question. But that's, I think, where the state of things is presently.
Great answer. And I'll let Tony dive in here in just 1 second. But a quick note, we had Representative Brian Mast on last month to chat about veterans' access to medical cannabis. And if you do decide to participate, he said, the more personalized your outreach, the more likely we are to respond. So just keep that in mind. Tony, I'm sorry, man. I mean to cut you off.
No.
Oh, no. You're muted. Brian, can you hear him? I can't hear him.
I'm sorry. I just clicked unmute. Okay, great. 30 seconds because I ate up too much time with that mute nonsense. But what do you have to say to the politicos who are still stalling on safe banking? Because like you said, a lot of people seem to be on board with that. But dispensaries still have to, you know, obviously they have to spend the money for guards and security and police officers to be present there because they're cash operations. And there has been holdups, as you said, like, is it too little too late at this point? Or what can we do to catalyze that? Well, what does a person in your position do to catalyze something like that?
Yeah, it's a great point. I'll mention, I focus mainly in the states. There are other individuals who spend a lot of time in Washington, and that's kind of where their focus is. But I do think that it's important to remember some of the history of cannabis and the prohibition. And this is why you have individuals like Booker and Sherrod Brown kind of putting pressure on legislators to add in, you know, social equity provisions. You have, it's not the Social Equity Council, it's not a caucus, but there's a group in Washington focused on social equity, and they, you know, submitted like a list of 10 things that they want to be a part of safe banking. I think it's important, though, to recognize that you can have what we call social equity, which is, you know, if you're dealing with social justice issues or things of that nature. But I would advocate that access to capital is a social equity issue. And so when you have individuals like Senator Booker, and I completely understand where he's coming from, and Sherrod Brown, I completely understand where they're coming from. But you also have what I would consider an industry that is moving very quickly. And it's the pieces on the board are getting eaten up very quickly. And when you have individuals who are on the sidelines and they're waiting for capital and they can't get access to capital, it's very difficult. And they're paying rent on these places, these locations. They're paying rent on a place that's generating no income. And so for those individuals, I think it's very difficult to say, okay, well, we're going to tell you to wait here while we get these other provisions in line. I think there is a way to get incremental wins. And this is oftentimes what we find in Washington or politics in general, is you can go for a home run or you can go for a single and get three more singles. And I think that's what we need to look at when we talk about social, not necessarily social equity, but the Safe Banking Act and attaching social equity provisions. Is I do think there's an opportunity to add in social equity provisions, but do you want all of them in there right now, which is likely to kill the bill, or can you get incremental things to make that happen? So, look, welcome to the world of politics.
Well said. So can I put you on the spot for a second, Brian? It's not going to be crazy, don't worry. But I am curious, you know, from your perspective. You know, we just talked a lot about social equity because you have to when it comes to the bills that are out there right now. And because as cannabis, you know, we should in terms of supporting that side of consumers and of business owners. We had a panel with the People's Ecosystem and several others earlier this month about just that. And one of the panelists said that she thinks social equity has been hijacked by political means. She thinks that actually the best states for social equity are unlimited license states and things move quicker for social equity business owners. On the other hand, that's not what's best for the likes of those who are actually leading cannabis into a regulated marketplace like Acreage, like Curaleaf, like Trulieve. So how do we balance this out? How do we, you know, continue to push for fair licensing, for good social equity programs on the government side, while also not sacrificing, if even sacrificing probably isn't a great word, but while also not, you know, cutting profits or shareholders, because there is a side to this where investors must have a say and must be considered. So, I mean, it's such a dichotomy right now.
Yeah, it's very nuanced, right? And so I think there's a state, I'm going to talk a little bit about Connecticut, that I think is done a really good job in, at least in theory, setting up social equity. The market's not open. So like Mike Tyson said, everybody has a strategy until you get punched in the mouth. So we have to wait and see what it looks like in Connecticut. But one of the things that Connecticut did that I personally think is a good way to look at it is they decided that they weren't going to bifurcate or put at odds industry and social equity operators. What they actually wanted to do is they have goals in their statute around social equity and ownership, but they wanted to incentivize industry and social equity operators to work together. And I think that's what regulators ought to be doing, is to say, all right, we're going to create a marketplace, but we want to create a marketplace where we're not pitting social equity and MSOs at odds, but how can we incentivize them to work together? And so when Connecticut said that, look, if you are a, you know, if you're an operator and you partner with a social equity joint venture, then the social equity joint venture owns X, Y, and Z amount. And, you know, you, of course, the balance is in the operator. But what that did was it allowed social equity to have ownership of their business. So it wasn't this usurious kind of lending practice, but it was a real incentive. And it's something that Acreage even took advantage of. And so I think there's ways for social equity operators, smaller operators, and MSOs to work in markets together, but it's going to take regulators to create the incentives for them to work together so that it's win-win on both sides. That's what I think.
It's interesting. And I'm curious to know, because I know we have a couple minutes left, but I would love to get your insight on what goes into a company's decision to leave a state entirely, maybe sell the assets like Acreage did with Oregon. Does politics play into that, or is that totally just a pure market then?
Yeah, from what I've seen, there are, like, I think it's business, you know, it's a business operations decision. I imagine there's probably going to be scenarios where companies will decide to leave markets because, you know, just the legislation or the regulation doesn't make it, you know, viable for them to actually earn a return for their shareholders. But, from what I've seen, a lot of it just comes down to it's just an operational decision.
Awesome. Great question. Great answer. So, Brian, anything else we need to know, my friend? You've been a wealth of knowledge here. Appreciate you coming on. Anything you want to leave us with? I know you don't have a crystal ball, but should we keep an eye out for something from Acreage or from otherwise as we move into the fall?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's important to watch how markets open. I think you have New York, you have Connecticut coming online. It's going to be really important to watch how those markets open and what those regulations look like. I think the mistake oftentimes we make is when a state goes legal, you know, we start doing circles around the block. But legalizing, you know, cannabis and regulating cannabis are very different. And it's the regulations that determine what the marketplace looks like. So I would just encourage everybody to be vigilant, to look at the regulations. And if you're an operator, if you have any kind of interest, reach out to your legislator. Let them know what you think is best for the cannabis market. We need everyone engaged in this opportunity.
Amen. We're all family here in this industry. Gotta be. But Brian, thank you so much again for coming on. Really appreciate it. Brian Murray, EVP of Government Relations for Acreage Holdings, an OG in the cannabis space. We're thrilled to host you. We look forward to having you back.
Thanks.
Thanks, Brian.
Man, two powerhouses. Honestly, I love shows like this.
What a great show. And not only did we get great insight on the political side, but also just on the industry side, the business side of things. Sometimes they're not mutually exclusive to each other. Yeah.
And I think it's foolish to underestimate how political the social equity side of this industry is. And right or wrong, it is right now. And it's something that people like Brian can shed light on for us all to understand and act on. If we so choose.
Yeah. Why don't they do unlimited licenses? That's so, no, have we ever addressed why they put a cap on certain licenses? And In New York, it's been a low cap, and I feel maybe we should do a follow-up with Brian to find out about like what he thinks about that.
That's an interesting question that I am not qualified to answer as to why there are limited license states, but I will say it does benefit the current structure of corporate cannabis.
Yeah.
So, you know, something to consider there, but I would say we need somebody much smarter than I to answer that question. With that being said, thank you all so much for tuning in today. Nomad, John Roeder, Sam Wetzel, thank you all. Please continue to tune in. We'll be back Thursday at 4 Eastern time with more great insights for you and news. Every morning, Cannabis Daily streams on Twitter and LinkedIn around 8:15, 8:30. I do the best I can to stay on time, but it varies between that mark. And that being said, you can always find all of our podcasts on Apple, Spotify, and other platforms. Benzinga.com/cannabis for Tony and Javier's amazing insights throughout the day. And with that being said, Tony, a pleasure, my friend. Always love it.
Pleasure, Elliot. Have a great afternoon and a wonderful night.
You too. Peace.
Take care.